A car heads north on Highway 36. Impala, going too fast by 10 as it crests the rise. Down the long incline, a dozen black crates in the road block the way forward. Coffins. The driver brakes and brings the car to a stop a few feet in front of the mass funeral. In the air above the coffins, on a traverse line cabled between two trees as stout as lighthouses, a mountain lioness climbs. A harness hugs her tawny waist, clipped by carabiner to a safety cable. Her tail swishes between sleek hind haunches, and her noble, whiskered head lolls on her neck as she inspects a snagged banner. A second car comes from the south. Rabbit, skidding to a stop in front of the coffins. It honks twice before the driver notices the cougar. The sight is odd enough, even here in Ganja Land, that the driver is happy for a minute just to gawk. The animal is young, live, and clothed only in a body stocking, with the words, "A change is gonna come," on her shoulder, peeking out from under the leotard. The cat fights with the banner. The drivers wait, curious. Another car gets trapped behind the northbound one, then another. On a roadside platform, a bear tugs on a leader, trying to pull the snagged bedsheet across its guy wire. The grizzly's snout and sunken eyes are gloriously painted papier-mâché. His eye holes are so small that the bear must wag its great muzzle to see anything. In a few more minutes, traffic starts to back up in both directions. Two guys get out of their cars. They're irate but can't help laughing at the megafauna. A swipe of the cougar's paw and the sheet finally drops, catches the wind, and flaps above the highway like a sail. Stop sacrificing virgins. The borders teem with fronds and flowers from the margins of a medieval manuscript. For a moment, the blocked commuters can only look. A few trapped drivers break into spontaneous applause. Someone calls from a roll-down window, "I'll help you with your virginity problem, honey." High above the roadway, the cougar waves. The hostages gesture back, thumbs or middle fingers. Her wild mask, gazing down from above, stirs some ancient hoo-ha into the spectator's viscera. One of the drivers charges the coffins. "My timber job pays for your welfare checks. Get the hell out of the road." He kicks at the black boxes, but they don't budge. From a choker around her neck, the cougar produces a whistle and toots three blasts. The crates open all together, and bodies rise like it's the last day. The bear adds to the chaos by tossing smoke bombs. Creatures emerge from each coffin, decked out in the colors of creation. There's an elk, whose antlers arc outward like angel wings, a Sonoma chipmunk with giant chopstick incisors, an Anna's hummingbird flashing hot pink and iridescent bronze, a Dalí nightmare of Pacific giant salamander, a sunny yellow blob of banana slug. The blocked drivers laugh at the animal resurrection. More applause and another round of profanity. The animals break into a wild dance. It unnerves the motorists. They've seen this bacchanal before, animals scampering in crazy circles, holdover memory from the illustrated pages of the first books they ever rubbed their fingers across, back when all things were possible and real. In the distraction of the animal dance, the bear and cougar unhook their harnesses and scramble down from their perches. When a police siren whoops from the rear of the backed-up cars, it sounds at first like another sideshow. The police slink up the blocked road's shoulder, giving the animals plenty of time to scatter into the understory. As they do, an older woman and a man with a video camera strapped to his palm disappear into the woods behind them. 2 days later, the film hits the national news. Reaction runs the living spectrum. The banner slingers are heroes. They're grandstanding criminals who ought to be locked up. They're animals. Animals, yes. Big-brained, altruistic, animal con artists who managed to block a state highway for a while and make it seem like wild things might have their way. 4 years at Fortuna College come down to one afternoon. Adam, in his spot in the front row, Daniel's auditorium. Professor Ruben Rabinowski at the podium. Affect and cognition. Last lecture before the final exam, and the Rabbi man is surveying all the experimental evidence that suggests, to the delight of the oversubscribed class, that teaching psychology is a waste of time. Now I'll show you the self-evaluations of people asked how susceptible they think they are to anchoring, causal base rate errors, the endowment effect, availability, belief perseverance, confirmation, illusory correlation, cueing. All the biases you've learned about in this course. Here are the scores of the control group, and here are the scores of people who've taken this course in previous years. Lots of laughs. The numbers are pretty much the same. Both groups confident of their iron will, clear vision, and independent thought. Here are the performances on several different evaluations designed to conceal what they were testing. Most of the second group were tested less than 6 months after they took this course. The laughter turns to groans, blindness and unreason rampant. Course grads working twice as hard to save $5 as they would to earn it. Grads fearing bears, sharks, lightning, and terrorists more than they fear drunk drivers. 80% thinking they're smarter than average. Grads wildly inflating how many jelly beans they think are in a jar based purely on someone else's ridiculous guesses. The psyche's job is to keep us blissfully ignorant of who we are, what we think, and how we'll behave in any situation. We're all operating in a dense fog of mutual reinforcement. Our thoughts are shaped primarily by legacy hardware that evolved to assume that everyone else must be right. But even when the fog is pointed out, we're no better at navigating through it. So why, you may ask, do I go on talking up here? Why go on, year after year, cashing the college's checks? The laughs are all sympathy now. Adam admires the brilliant pedagogy. He, at least, he vows, will remember this lecture a year from now. And its revelations will make him wiser, no matter what the studies show. He, at least, will defy the indicting numbers. Let me show you the answers you yourselves gave to a simple questionnaire I had you fill out at the beginning of the semester. You've probably forgotten you ever took it. The professor glances at the average answers and grimaces. His lips tighten in pain. Snickers across the room. You may or may not recall that I asked you then whether you thought you'd... Professor Rabinowski fiddles with his tie. He windmills with his left arm, grimaces again. Excuse me 1 minute. He lurches off the dais and out the door. A murmur passes through the auditorium. Thuds come from down the hall. A stack of boxes tipping over. 54 students sit and wait for the punchline. Faint, swallowed sounds fill the hallway, but no one moves. Adam scans the seats behind him. Students frown at each other or busy themselves with notes. He turns to look at that magnificent woman who always sits 2 seats to his left. Pre-med, fawn-colored, pretty without knowing it. Binders full of neat handwritten notes, and he thinks again how glorious it would be to sit in Bucky's over a beer with her and talk about this astonishing class. But the semester ends in 2 days, and the chance is as good as lost. She glances his way, confused. He shakes his head and can't help smirking. He leans in to whisper, and she reciprocates. Maybe the chance hasn't vanished.
Kitty Genovese, The Bystander Effect, Darley and Latané, 1968.
But is he okay? Her breath is like cinnamon.
Remember how we had to answer whether we'd help someone who...
A woman shouts from below for someone to call an ambulance. But by the time the paramedics get their ambulance onto the quad, Professor Rabinowski is dead of a myocardial infarction.
I don't understand, the pre-med beauty says in their booth at Bucky's. If you thought he was demonstrating the bystander effect, why did you keep sitting there?
She's on her third iced coffee, and it bothers Adam. That's not the point. The question is why 53 other people, including you, who thought he was having a heart attack, didn't do anything. I thought he was jerking us around to make a point.
Then you should have been on your feet and calling his bluff.
I didn't want to spoil the show.
You should have been up in 5 seconds.
He slams the booth table. It wouldn't have made any damn difference. She flinches into the booth, like he meant to hit her. He puts up his palms, leans toward her to apologize, and she flinches again. He freezes, hands in the air, seeing what the cowering woman sees. I'm sorry. You're right.
Professor Rabinowski's last lesson. Learning psychology is indeed pretty much useless.
He pays for the drinks and leaves. He never sees her again, except for the following week, from 4 seats away, for 2 hours, at the proctored final exam. He's admitted to the new social psychology graduate program down at Santa Cruz. The campus is an enchanted garden perched on a mountainside overlooking Monterey Bay. It's the worst place he can imagine for finishing a doctorate or doing any real work whatsoever. On the other hand, it's perfect for making interspecies contact with sea lions down by the pier, climbing the sunset tree, naked and stoned at night, and lying on his back in the great meadow, searching for a thesis topic in the mad clouds of stars. After 2 years, the other grads take to calling him Bias Boy. In any discussion of the psychology of social formations, Adam Apich, Master of Science, is there with several studies that show how legacy cognitive blindness will forever prevent people from acting in their own best interests. He consults with his advisor, Professor Mieke van Dijk, she of the sublime Dutch bob, clipped consonants, and soft-core softened vowels. In fact, she makes him confer with her every 2 weeks in her office up in College 10, hoping the enforced check-in will jumpstart his research.
You are dragging your feet over nothing.
In fact, he has had his feet up, reclining on her Victorian daybed across the office from her desk, as if she's psychoanalyzing him. It amuses them both.
Dragging? Not at all. I am utterly paralyzed.
But why? You make too big a deal about this. Think of a thesis.
She can't pronounce the TH.
As a long seminar project. You don't have to save the world.
I don't? Can I at least save a nation-state or two?
She laughs. Her wide overbite quickens his pulse.
Listen, Adam. Pretend this has nothing to do with your career. Nothing to do with any professional approval. What do you, personally, want to discover? What would give you enjoyment to study for a couple of years?
He watches the words spill from that pretty mouth, free from the social scientific jargon that she tends to drop into in seminars.
This enjoyment you speak about, tsh, you want to know something.
He wants to know whether she has ever, even once, thought of him sexually. It isn't inconceivable. She's only a decade older than he is, and she is, he wants to say, robust.
He feels a weird need to tell her how he got here, in her office looking for a thesis topic. Wants to draw his entire intellectual history in a straight line, from daubing nail polish on the abdomens of ants to watching his beloved undergraduate mentor die, then ask her where the line leads next.
I'm interested in unblinding.
He steals a look at her. If only people, like some invertebrates, would just turn raging purple when they felt attraction, it would make the entire species so much less neurotic. She purses her lips. She must know how good that looks on her. Unblinding? I'm sure that must mean something.
Can people come to independent moral decisions that run counter to their tribe's beliefs?
You want to study transformative potential as a function of strong normative in-group favoritism.
He'd nod, but the jargon bugs the crap out of him.
It's like this. I think of myself as a good man, a good citizen, but say I'm a good citizen of early Rome, when a father had the power and sometimes the duty to put his child to death.
I see. And you, a good citizen, are motivated to preserve positive distinctiveness.
We're trapped by social identity, even when there are big, huge truths staring us in.
He hears his peers jeering, "Bias, boy."
Well, no, clearly not, or in-group realignment would never happen. Transformation of social identity.
Does it?
Of course. Here in America, people went from believing that women are too frail to vote to having a major party vice presidential candidate in one lifetime, from Dred Scott to emancipation in a few years. Children, foreigners, prisoners, women, blacks, the disabled and mentally ill, they've all gone from property to personhood. I was born at a time when the idea of a chimpanzee getting a hearing in a court of law seemed totally absurd. By the time you're my age, we'll wonder how we ever denied such animals their standing as intelligent creatures.
How old are you, anyway?
Professor Van Dyck laughs. Her fine, high cheekbones pink out. He's sure of it. Tough to hide with that complexion.
Topic, please.
I'd like to determine the personality factors that make it possible for some individuals to wonder how everyone can be so blind
while everyone else is still trying to stabilize in-group loyalties. Now we get somewhere. This could be a topic with much more narrowing and definition. You could look at the next step in this same historical progression of consciousness. Study those people who support a position that any reasonable person in our society thinks is crazy.
For instance,
we are living at a time when claims are being made for a moral authority that lies beyond the human.
One smooth tensing of his abdominal muscles and he sits up.
What do you mean?
You've seen the news. People up and down this coast are risking their lives for plants. I read a story last week. A man who had his legs sheared off by a machine he tried to chain himself to.
Adam has seen the stories, but he ignored them. Now he can't see why.
Plant rights? Plant personhood?
A boy he knew once jumped into a hole and risked live burial to protect his unborn brother's sapling from harm. That boy is dead.
I hate activists.
So, why?
Orthodoxy and sloganeering? Boring. I hate it when those Greenpeace guys shake me down on the street. Anyone who gets righteous doesn't understand.
Understand what?
how hopelessly fragile and wrong we all are about everything.
Professor Van Dijk frowns. I see. Good thing we aren't doing a psychological study of you.
Are these people really appealing to a new non-human moral order? Or are they just being sentimental about pretty green things?
That's where controlled psychological measurements come in. He smirks a little himself, but something large wells up in him, and he can't even shift his weight or it will disappear. A way forward.
Identity formation and big five personality factors among plants' rights activists.
Or, who does the tree hugger really hug when he hugs a tree?
The sun shines on the Western Cascades as Mimi and Douglas pull onto the car-packed Forest Service road. Bodies mill about the small clearing. This isn't a protest march, it's a carnival. The ceramic mold manager asks the wounded vet, "Who are all these people?" Dougie steps from the car with that stupid, air-eating, sun-eating grin Mimi has come to enjoy, the way you might enjoy the yips of a dog you've rescued from the pound. He waves his work-gnarled hands across the crowd in goofy cowboy joy.
Homo sapiens, man! Always up to something!
Mimi trots to catch up with him. The turnout dizzies her.
What they do?
Douglas leans his good ear toward her.
How's that?
The crowd is loud in the circus of their cause, and he's lost a lot of hearing from his days in transport planes. It still surprises her, a man who bothers to listen.
My father used to say that. What they do?
What they do?
Yeah, meaning, what the hell do those people hope to accomplish?
Was he strange?
Chinese. He believed English should be more efficient than it is.
Douglas smacks his forehead.
You're Chinese!
Half Chinese. What did you think?
I don't know, something swarthier.
The real question, Mimi knows, is what she do? She's amazed he managed to get her up here for this protest. Her only previous political action was a grade school vendetta against Chairman Mao. Her grudge is with the city, its scheming nighttime raid against her pines. As for these trees, so far out of town, she's an engineer for crying out loud. These trees are calling out to be used. But a pair of lectures and a visit to an organizational meeting, accompanied by this clumsy innocent, have broken her heart. These mountains, these forest cascades, now that she has seen them, they're hers. So here she is, at a public demonstration that would have made her emigrant father come pluck her home in fear of deportation, torture, or worse. Look at everyone! It's grannies with guitars and toddlers with space-age water pistols. College students out to prove themselves worthy of one another. Preppers pushing baby carriages like all-terrain Hobbit Humvees. Grade school kids carrying earnest placards. Respect your elders. We need our lungs. A rainbow alliance of assorted footwear makes its way up the trunk to the hall road. Loafers and cross trainers, backward-sloping sandals, cracked-toe Chuck Taylors, and, yes, logger calks. The clothes are still more varied. Button-down Oxfords and pre-stressed jeans, tie-dye and flannel, hickory shirts, even a U.S. Air Force flight jacket, like the one Dougie pawned for a few bucks 15 years ago. Clown suits, swimsuits, jumpsuits, every kind of suit, except three-piecers. Much of the crowd has been bussed to the site by four wildly different environmental outfits that tend to go to war with one another when there's no closer target.
A group of backpackers took 2 days making their way overland to join this spectacle, all trying to bail out the ocean of capitalism with an acorn cap. A handful of locals show up to watch. Out this far, most of the people in a 100-mile radius exist by grace of timber. They have their hand-lettered signs as well. Loggers, the real endangered species. Earth first. We'll log the other planets later. 2 men sporting beards down to their sternums hover around the periphery, pointing shoulder-mount video cameras. A gray-haired woman in danskins, felt fedora, and sleeveless vest tapes interviews with anyone who'll talk. Deeper into the trees, a man and woman with megaphones shape the crowd's mood. People, you're amazing! What a turnout! Thank you all! Ready for a walk in the woods? A cheer erupts, and the parade lurches down a gravel path toward the fresh skid road. Douglas falls into step, Mimi alongside. They weave into the colorful crowd, waving rainbow banners and shouting outrageous epithets. In the festive atmosphere, under so blue a sky, walking arm in arm with strangers up the slight grade, Mimi sees. For her entire life, unwittingly, she has complied with her parents' first shared principle, make no noise in this world. She, Carmen, Amelia, all 3 Ma girls, don't stand out. You have no right. No one owes you a thing. Keep small, vote mainstream, and nod like it all makes sense. Yet here she is, asking for trouble, acting like what she does might matter. They walk shoulder to shoulder across the skid road, 10 abreast, more rows deep than she can count. They sing tunes that Mimi last sang in summer camp in northern Illinois, songs of jingly childhood. This land is your land, if I had a hammer. Dougie smiles and hums along in a toneless bass. Between songs, a cheerleader with a megaphone, walking sideways near the front of the pack, stirs up some call and response. Clear cuts cost too much. Save our last stands. Righteousness makes Mimi nuts. She has always been allergic to people with conviction. But more than she hates conviction, she hates sneaky power. She has learned things about this mountainside that sicken her. A wealthy logging outfit, backed by a pro-industry forest circus, is exploiting the power vacuum prior to a big court decision by rushing through an illegal grab of mixed conifers that have been growing for centuries before the idea of ownership came to these parts. She's ready to try anything to slow theft down, even righteousness. They hike through dense spruce for the length of 3 choruses. Trunks slice the sunlight into shards. Godfingers, she and her sisters used to call those slanted beams. Trees she can't name shoot up all around, wrapped in vines, or tumbling to the ground like barricades. So much life in so many flavors, she wants to strip down and scamper. The understory is shot through with saplings she could encircle with her fist, broomsticks that may have bidden their time for 100 years. But the canopy is carried by trunks that several arm-linked protesters still could not hug. Vistas open up through the green crenellations. Mimi tugs Doug's sleeve and points. To the northeast, down ravines and up slopes too steep to walk, a pincushion of health rolls over the hills. Fog wraps the tops of the firs the way it did on the day the first European ships sniffed out harbors on this coast. But through another gap to the south, lunar devastation runs up the mountainside. Slash doused with diesel and burnt until even the fungus is dead, then drowned with herbicide so nothing will grow again but this company's monocrop row plantations in a short cycle that, she has learned, will last only a few more rounds at most before the soil is dead. From on high, it feels as if even the trees spreading across these slopes are at war. patches of lush green march against patches of muddy vomit all the way to the horizon. And the people assembled here, ignorant armies going up against each other as they have forever, for reasons hidden from even the most vehement. When will it be enough? Now, if you can believe this chanting, laughing crowd on its way to convince the road crew at the end of these wheel ruts. Now, the second best of times. The road narrows, and the emerald forest thickens. Monster trunks dwarf and disorient Mimi. Moss grows up and over everything in thick blankets. Even the ferns reach to her breasts. The man beside her knows the names of trees, but Mimi is too proud to ask for IDs. Despite a decade of living in this state, despite repeated attempts to master the field guides and dichotomous keys, she can't tell a limber from a sugar pine, let alone a Port Orford from an incense cedar. Silver, white, red, and grand firs are all a frilly blur, and the swarming understory, impossible. Salal, somehow, she knows, oxalis and trillium, but the rest is a tossed salad of inscrutable foliage, creeping up to trailside, ready to grab her ankles. Douglas points off to the left of the road.
Look!
In the middle of the blue-green confusion, seven stout trees grow in a line as straight as Euclid's daydreams. How the hell? Did someone... He laughs and pats her shoulder. The touch feels good.
Think back. Think way back.
She does and sees nothing. Douglas milks the suspense a little longer.
Few hundred years ago, right around the time the pilgrims were thinking, what the fuck, huh? Let's go for it. Some big monster fell. Log rot's a perfect seedbed. Bunch of seedlings used it as a furrow, like God sowed them in with a hoe.
Something glints in front of her, revealed by the dappled light, the way dew betrays a spider web. Tight nets of tens of thousands of species knit together in weaves too fine for any person to trace. Who knows what medicines might be hidden here? The next aspirin, the next quinine, the next Taxol. Reason enough that this last little stand should stay intact a little longer.
Something, isn't it?
Is, Dougals. This man tried to save her pines. Put his body between the saws and the trees. She wouldn't be out here, even in this endangered paradise, without him. But for her money, he's more than a little whacked. His rangy gameness for anything scares her. The twinkle he fixes on the forest ahead has that look of the not entirely housebroken. His head swivels, marveling at the crowd, happy as a puppy to be let back in the house.
Hear that? Douglas asks.
But she has heard it all morning. In another quarter mile, the dull whine sharpens. Down the road, through the brambles, mustard and orange machines claw the earth. Graders and scrapers pushing this road into new territory.
Ah, geez, Mimi. Look what they're doing to this beautiful place. What they do.
The protesters reach a gate of welded metal bars across the road. The advance guard stops at the obstacle, and the banners pool around them. The megaphone woman says, "We're about to cross over into the cut. This will be an encroachment of the timber plan we're contesting. Those of you who are unwilling to be arrested, remain here. Your presence and voices are still important. The press is taking notice of your feelings." Applause, like the flutter of grouse.
"Those willing to head on, thank you. We'll cross now. Stay orderly, stay calm. Do not allow yourself to be provoked. This is a peaceful confrontation."
A portion of the crowd drifts toward the gate. Mimi cocks an eyebrow at Douglas. You're sure?
Shit, yeah. That's why we're here, isn't it?
She wonders if he means here on the edge of a national forest being sold to the top bidder, or here on Earth, the only entity capable of prospection. She shrugs away all philosophy. Let's go. 10 more yards, and they're criminals. The roar grows sickening. In half a mile, they're up against human ingenuity at its best. She can name the metal beasts better than she can name the different trees. Down through the clearing, there's a feller buncher, snatching batches of small trunks, delimbing them, and bucking the logs to fixed lengths, doing in a day what a team of human cutters would need a week to get through. There's a self-loading forwarder trailer, stacking the cut logs into itself. Nearer by, a front loader extends the roadbed, and a scraper rough grades it prior to the arrival of the roller. She's learned of machines that drop their maws onto 50-foot trees and grind them to the ground faster than a food processor can shred a carrot. Machines that stack logs like toothpicks and haul them to mills where 20-foot trunks twirl on spits so fast that the touch of an angled blade shaves off the flesh in a continuous layer of veneer. Hard hats block the road ahead of them. Their foreman says, "You're trespassing." The megaphone woman, on whom Mimi has developed a schoolgirl crush, says, "These are public lands." The other megaphone wielder gives the command, and marchers fan out across the dirt roadbed. They sit down, shoulder to shoulder, spanning the road. Mimi and Doug link arms, joining the solidifying line. Mimi locks in, clasping her hands in front of her. The inward-turned mulberry of her jade ring presses into her other wrist. By the time the loggers see what's happening, the deed is done. The two ends of the human chain lock themselves with bike cables to trees on either side of the road. Two fellers walk right up to the arm-locked line. The tops of their steel-reinforced boots come almost to Mimi's eyes. "Shit," a blonde one says. Mimi sees his genuine distress. "When are you people going to grow up and get real? Why don't you take care of your own business and let us get on with ours?" "This is everybody's business," Douglas answers. Mimi tugs at him. "You know where the real problems are? Brazil, China. That's where the crazy cutting is. You should go protest down there. See what they think when you tell them they can't get as rich as we are." "You're cutting down the last American old growth." "You wouldn't know old growth if it fell on you. We've been cutting these hillsides for decades, and we've been replanting 10 trees for each one we cut." "Correction. I've been replanting 10 little paper pulp seedlings for each one of these varied ancient geniuses." Mimi watches the foreman make all kinds of cost-benefit calculations. It's a funny thing about capitalism. Money you lose by slowing down is always more important than money you've already made. One of the fellers swings his boot and flicks a pad of mud up into Douglas's face. Mimi loosens her arm to clean it off, but Doug clasps her in his bicep. Another fleck of mud. "Oh, sorry, guy. My mistake." Mimi interrupts. "You punk thug! Take it up with these guys. Sue me from your jail cell." The feller points off behind the seated line where police are pouring down the Forest Service road in force. They break the chain like someone plucking a dandelion. Then they handcuff the broken links back together. Mimi and Douglas end up with two strangers chained between them and two more on each side. They're left to sit in the muddy road while the police mop up the chaos. "I need to pee," Mimi tells a cop around 2 o'clock. Half an hour later, she tells the same cop, again, I really, really need to urinate.
No, you don't. You really don't.
Urine leaks down her leg. She starts sobbing. The women she's cuffed to gag and grimace.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I couldn't hold it.
Shh. It's okay,
Douglas says, handcuffed two bodies down.
Don't think about it.
Her sobs get frantic.
It's okay, Douglas keeps saying. I've got my arm around you, in my head.
The crying stops. It won't start up again for years. Smelling like an animal-marked stump, Mimi submits to arrest and booking. As the lady officer in the station takes her fingerprints, she feels, for the first time since her father's death, like she's given the day everything it wanted. The kiss comes down on the crown of Ray's head from behind, where he sits in his study reading. Kisses, brisk and precise, like wire-guided bomblets, are Dorothy's trademark these days. It never fails to make his blood run cold.
Off to sing!
He cranes to look at her. She's 44, but looks to him as she did at 28. It's the not having babies, he thinks, the bloom still coursing through her, the pure lure, as if ridiculous loveliness still had a job to do this far past youth. Jeans and a white cotton blouse gathered in pleats that cling to her plaintive ribs. Topped with a lilac shawl, sweetly disheveled and swept across her neck, the one stretch of skin she thinks betrays her. Her hair falls on the shawl, shiny, chestnut, perfect, still the length it was when she tried out for Lady Macbeth on their first date.
You look so beautiful.
Ha! Huh, I'm glad your eyes are failing.
She tickles the spot where her kiss landed. Thinning up here. Time's winged chariot. I'm trying to picture such a vehicle. How would that work, exactly? He cranes further. Clasped in one hand against her runner's thighs, she holds a pale green Peter's edition, emblazoned with the giant black word, Brahms, broken in two by her perfect forearm. Beneath that, smaller, Ein Deutsches Requiem. The concert is at the end of June. She'll stand on stage with 100 other voices, inconspicuous among the women except for being one of the few who are not yet gray, and sing, Siehe, ein Ackermann wartet auf die köstliche Frucht der Erde und ist geduldig darüber, bis empfahe den Morgenregen und Abendregen. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth and hath long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. Singing is now everything. It follows on a line of hobbies she has hit hard in the hopes of passing the week as maximally as possible. Swimming, life-saving, life-drawing in charcoal and pastels. Meanwhile, he has withdrawn into the stronghold of his study. He bills more hours of work than ever, in the vague hope of buying a second home for them, someplace more beautiful, someplace surrounded, if not by wilderness, then by the memory of it.
Lots of rehearsals.
2 2-hour rehearsals every week, and she hasn't missed one.
They're fun.
She has been overprepared for weeks. Truth is, she has practiced so hard at home that she could sing this piece tonight from start to finish, every vocal line.
Sure you don't want to come? We need more basses.
More than ever, she astonishes him. What would she do if he said yes?
Maybe in the fall, for the Mozart.
You've got enough to keep you busy?
This is what people do. Solve their own problems in others' lives. He laughs.
At the moment, yes. I'm wrestling with this.
He holds the pages up to her. Should Trees Have Standing? She reads the title and frowns. Ray examines the words, puzzled himself. He seems to be saying that the law's shortfall is that it only recognizes human victims. And that's a problem? He wants to extend rights to non-human things. He wants trees to be rewarded for their intellectual property. She smirks.
Bad for business, huh?
I don't know whether to throw it across the room and laugh, or to set it on fire and kill myself.
Let me know which you decide. See you between 10 and 11. Don't wait up if you're sleepy.
I'm sleepy already. He laughs again as if he just made a joke. You warm enough? It's going to get chilly. Button up your overcoat. She seizes up in the doorway, and the moment is there again between them. The sudden upwell of anger and mutual defeat. I'm not your property, Ray. We had a deal.
What is this? I didn't say you were my property.
You certainly did, she says, and is gone. Only when the door hammers shut does he make the leap. Overcoats, buttons, wind blowing free. Take good care of yourself. You belong to me. She drives off down Birch to the west under orange maples. He doesn't bother to watch the taillights or see where she turns. It would be an indignity to them both. She's too smart not to drive past the rehearsal auditorium first. Besides, he's already stood at the window on previous nights and watched the taillights. He's done it all. All things desperate and disgusting. Looked up the unknown numbers on the phone bill log, checked the pockets of her previous night's clothes, gone through her purse for notes. He finds no notes, just courtroom exhibits A through Z of his shame. His weeks of disbelief long ago changed into a free fall many times scarier than their youthful stint at skydiving. The panic of discovery soon thickened into grief, the kind he felt when his mother died. Then grief transmuted into virtue, which he nursed in secrecy for weeks, until virtue collapsed under its own explosive growth into bitter immobility. Every question is a voluntary madness. Who? Why? How long? How often before? What does it matter? Leave your overcoat unbuttoned. Now he just wants peace and to be near her a little longer, for as long as he can, before she smashes everything just to punish him for finding out. She parks her car in the lot behind the auditorium. She even goes in for a minute, not so much to establish an alibi as to make the trap door that opens under her feel that much crazier. When the 100 singers mill onto the risers, she slips out the back as if to retrieve something she left in her car. In a minute, she's on the rain-slicked street, cold, living, heart beating like mad. She's going to get done. Several different ways, long and lovingly and to no purpose, with no contractual obligations, by a man she doesn't know from Adam. The thought runs the length of her, like she just injected something. She's going to be bad. Bad again. Stupid bad. Do things she never imagined she could do. New things. Going to learn more about herself, scary more, at high speed, joyously. What she likes and doesn't, when she isn't lying the lazy lie of decency. Put the last 30 years to the heat-freeing flames. The thought shatters her. Magic. Growth. And she's damp and practically coming from the swish of her own legs, like a pith-green girl of 16 by the time she sees the black BMW at curbside and lets herself in. 48 minutes of wilderness experiment. Immediately afterward, she has trouble remembering, like maybe he did drug her just a little, for fun. She remembers sitting up on her spread knees on the giant bed, giggling like a blitzed sorority princess. She remembers growing huge, poetic, queenly, godlike, a flood of Brahms. Then falling back into the pain in her legs and lungs, a distance runner. She remembers him whispering in her ear as he fingered her, vague, threatening, worshipful, thrilling syllables that she fed on without quite making out. Every so often in the bobbing sea, as they did the week before, details from her favorite adultery novels flashed in her head with horrible specificity. She remembers thinking, now I'm the heroine of my own doomed story. Then a long and tender kiss goodnight, curbside in the dark car, 3 blocks from the auditorium. 10 steps down the slick sidewalk, she consigns the whole adventure to imagination, something that happened only in a book. She's back inside and up on the risers with time to spare, waiting for the return of the choral swell as the baritone sings, "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye." Ray nibbles on dinner, pistachios and an apple. Reading is slow and all things distract him. Staring at the bottom of the apple's core, he realizes that the calyx, a word he'll never know in this life, is nothing less than the leftover bits of a withered apple flower. He looks up from the thicket of words 3 times a minute, waiting for truth to hit like a falling oak smashing through the house's roof. Nothing comes to kill him. Nothing at all happens, and it keeps on happening with great force and patience. Nothing happens so completely that when he checks his watch to see why Dorothy isn't home yet, he's stunned to discover that less than 30 minutes has passed. He bows his head and fixes on the page. The article stokes his distress. Should trees have standing? This time last month, it would have been his evening's great sport to test the ingenious argument. What can be owned, and who can do the owning? What conveys a right, and why should humans alone on all the planet have them? But tonight, the words swim. 8:37. Everything that was his is going down, and he doesn't even know what brought on disaster. The terrible logic of the essay begins to wear him down. Children, women, slaves, aboriginals, the ill, insane, and disabled, all changed unthinkably over the centuries into persons by the law. So why shouldn't trees and eagles and rivers and living mountains be able to sue humans for theft and endless damages? The whole idea is a holy nightmare. A death dance of justice, like the one he now lives through, watching the second hand of his watch refuse to move. His entire career until this moment, protecting the property of those with a right to grow, begins to seem like one long war crime, like something he'll be imprisoned for come the revolution. "The proposal is bound to sound odd, or frightening, or laughable. This is partly because until the rightless thing receives its rights, we cannot see it as anything but a thing for the use of us, those who are holding rights at the time." 8:42, and he's desperate. He'll do anything now to deceive her, to make her think he has no idea. Her fit of craziness will run its course. The fever that has turned her into someone he can't recognize will burn away and leave her well again. Shame will bring her back to herself, and she'll remember everything. The years, the time they went to Italy, the time they jumped from the plane, the time she ran the car into a tree while reading his anniversary letter and almost killed herself, the amateur theatrics, the things they planted together in the backyard they made. It is no answer to say that streams and forests cannot have standing because streams and forests cannot speak. Corporations cannot speak either, nor can states, estates, infants, incompetents, municipalities, or universities. Lawyers speak for them.
The key thing is for her never to learn that he knows. He must be cheerful, smart, funny. The minute she suspects, it'll destroy them both. She might live with anything except being forgiven. But concealment is killing him. He never could play anyone but an Ernest Macduff. 8:48. He tries to concentrate. The evening stretches out ahead like two consecutive life sentences. He has only this essay to keep him company and torture him.
What is it within us that gives us this need not just to satisfy basic biological wants, but to extend our wills over things, to objectify them, to make them ours, to manipulate them, to keep them at a psychic distance?
The essay flickers under his fingers. He can't follow it, can't decide whether it's brilliant or rubbish. His whole self is dissolving. All his rights and privileges, everything he owns. A great gift that has been his since birth is being taken away. It's a grand, luxurious act of self-deceit, an outright lie, that claim of Kant's. As far as non-humans are concerned, we have no direct duties. All exists merely as means to an end. That end is man. Disgust breaks over her as she drives home. But even disgust feels like freedom. If a person can see the worst in herself, if a person can find total honesty, complete knowledge of what she really is, now that she's sated, she wants purity again. At the light at Snelling, she looks up into the rearview mirror and sees her eyes hiding from her own furtive glance. She thinks, I'll stop. Get my life back. Decency. This doesn't have to end in a flaming fireball. The coming concert performance can absorb her excess energy. After that, she'll find something else to occupy her, to keep her sane and sober. By Lexington, 10 blocks down, she's planning one more dose. Just one more, to remind her what it feels like to ski this mountain continent. She won't be pathetic. She'll have the addiction without the pitiful resolutions. She doesn't know what's addicted, her body or her will. She knows only that she'll follow herself down to wherever it takes her. By the time she turns onto their street's leafy canyon, she's calm again. She comes in rosy from the cold. Her scarf trails as she pushes the door shut behind her. The Requiem score drops from her hands. She bends to pick it up, and when she straightens, their eyes catch, spilling everything. Scared, defiant, pleading, thuggish. Wanting to be home again with an old friend.
Hey, you haven't budged from that chair.
Good rehearsal?
The best.
I'm glad. What sections did you sing?
She crosses to where he sits, something of their old rhythm. She hugs him,
ziemlich langsam und mit Ausdruck.
Before he can stand, she slips past into the kitchen, smelling on herself that blend of salt and bleach.
I'll just take a quick shower before bed.
She's a smart woman, but she has never had much patience with the obvious. Nor does she think him capable of simple observation. She showered 20 minutes before heading out to sing her Brahms.